You're listening to a Bible study by Jack Kelly. For more free Bible study resources, visit our website at gracethroughfaith.com.
Tonight, we'll be in Daniel chapter 8. As you remember, the book of Daniel is divided into two parts, really. The first six chapters are basically a summary of Daniel's life, and they contain lots of good information for us and lots of important biblical principles that we follow. And most people know a lot more about the first half of the book of Daniel than they do the second half, because beginning in Daniel 7, the rest of the book, the last half of the book, is a compilation of prophetic events that took place in Daniel's life, things that we would call end time prophecy. It was interesting to me to learn that in the Jewish version of the Old Testament, Daniel is not placed among the prophets. We consider, Christians consider Daniel to be one of the major prophets, the big four. Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Daniel are the big four of the prophets, let's call it, in the Old Testament. But in the Jewish Bible, that's not the case. Daniel is not placed among the prophets. He's placed among what's called the writings. And the reason for that is they don't believe he qualified as a prophet because he got all of his messages, all of his prophetic messages, through angels instead of speaking directly to God. And in the Hebrew tradition, a prophet had to speak directly with God in order to be a prophet. And so it's just a little tidbit I learned. Doesn't mean anything as far as we're concerned, because we see Daniel as one of the great prophets. And in our time, we see many of the things that Daniel's written about having come true with a dramatic specificity, and in many cases, more so than any other of the prophets. And so that's just a little piece of information. But these last six chapters of the book of Daniel are given over to these various things, and they're not done chronologically. They're put in an order that Daniel chose, and they're not connected to one another like the first half of the book was. Each one stands on its own. Daniel chapter 8 is a self-contained prophecy about the era we know as a Gentile dominion, where the Gentile kingdoms had held sway over the earth for the most part. Daniel chapter 2 gave us a heads up about that, a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, showing how the Gentile kingdoms would have dominion over the earth, and they have had so pretty much unabated, uninterrupted, ever since the times of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, which began about 605 BC when Nebuchadnezzar sort of consolidated all of his power in gaining control over pretty much all the known world. And that began the Gentile dominion, the era of the Gentiles. That continues into our time. A succession of Gentile kingdoms have been most important in the world after Babylon. You know, it was the coalition of the Medes and the Persians. After them came the Greeks, and after the Greeks came the Romans. And the Romans have pretty much, although the Roman Empire has broken up and reinvented itself on a number of occasions, components of the Roman Empire have pretty much been the premier nations ever since. But Daniel's prophecies tell us that that's going to end soon, and the kingdom of God will come and be the everlasting kingdom on earth. And so Daniel was told that there would only be four of the Gentile kingdoms, and then the Lord would return. And so we've seen the Babylonian kingdom, we've seen the Media-Persia, we've seen Greeks, we've seen the Romans, and the Romans are the last ones. And the next one to come will be the kingdom of God. And so we're living in times when many people who study prophecy believe the era of Gentile dominion is about over. An interesting prophecy that Jesus made in Luke was that the Gentiles would trample on Jerusalem until the times of the Gentiles were fulfilled. And so from about 32 years after he made that prophecy until 1967, just a few years ago, 40 years ago, the city of Jerusalem was given over to the Gentiles. It wasn't until June 1967, that Jerusalem became a unified Jewish city once again. And the Lord said when we saw that happen, that would be the sign that Gentile dominion is about to come to an end. And so that's one of the major events in our lifetime that we herald as a major milestone in end time prophecy, second only probably to the rebirth of the nation Israel itself. And so this time that Daniel's writing about is a very critical time to us, because we see so much of it fulfilled in history, and yet we also are going to see in surprising detail some things that are going to happen in the near future as well. And one of the things we'll focus on tonight is how quite often visions that were given to prophets had dual fulfillments. They would have a fulfillment in what we would call history. They were all prophetic to the prophet. In other words, they all happened after the prophet was given the vision. But some of it has already been fulfilled in history. And yet, that same prophecy will be fulfilled once again. And the scholars call this a dual fulfillment, or sometimes they call the first one a local fulfillment. The reason for all that is that the early or partial fulfillment was meant to confirm the prophecy in the eyes of man, so that they would expect the ultimate and complete fulfillment to come later. You know, in the book of Deuteronomy, it says that if a prophet ever said something that didn't come true, then the Lord said, well, you know that I didn't tell the prophet to say that, because everything I tell a prophet to say is going to come true. Well, when you get to some of these long-range prophecies, they didn't come true in the lifetime of the prophet. And so quite often the Lord would have an interim or local fulfillment, partially fulfilling the prophecy. And then later on, that you would know that later on the whole prophecy would be fulfilled. Here's a simple example. When Jesus was just a little while before his final days on earth, he said, I have come in my Father's name, and you did not accept me. He says, another will come in his own name, and you'll accept him. Now, he's speaking about the Antichrist, because the prophets tell us that the Messiah would be rejected by the people, but that later on, they would accept a false Messiah. And that false Messiah is the one we know of as the Antichrist. And when he comes, and we're going to see a little bit of this tonight, when he comes into the world, the whole world pretty much will accept him, whereas they rejected the real Messiah. Okay, so that was a long, long-range prophecy. How did that get a partial fulfillment? Well, just a short time after that, Jesus was standing at the judgment seat along with Pontius Pilate and one other prisoner, a guy named Barabbas. And Pontius Pilate gave the crowd the choice. Who do you want me to free, the Messiah or Barabbas? And of course, the crowd chose Barabbas, and that gave the partial fulfillment of the prophecy. Here was the man who had come in God's name. Here was the man who was there in his own name. And who did they choose? Choose the one who came in his own name. Now, that wasn't the complete fulfillment of that prophecy. It just let us know that there will one day be a complete fulfillment of the prophecy, because nobody in those days expected that Barabbas was the Messiah. And yet, he did fulfill the qualification of having come in his own name. And so, you get those ideas. Prophecy students have all kinds of different names for these kinds of things, but I just like to call them dual fulfillments. And we're going to see one, a very dramatic one, unfold in Daniel chapter 8 tonight. Okay, so this prophecy, this vision of Daniel's, took place, as verse 1 of chapter 8 tells us, in the third year of King Belshazzar. You know that Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. He was the last king of Babylon. It was during the reign of Belshazzar that Daniel 6 took place. The handwriting on the wall. I'm sorry, Daniel 5. That's the handwriting on the wall. And so this prophecy is in the third year of his reign. So we're going to back up in time now, and we're going to see this prophecy that Daniel was given somewhere between the time that Nebuchadnezzar's grandson took office and the time when he was eliminated, we'll say, on the night that the Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon. The year, as it turns out, we can date this because it tells us it's the third year of his reign, and that makes it 551 BC. That means it's 2 years, it's been 2 years since the vision that we talked about last time in Daniel 7. Daniel 7 was given in 553 BC. This one's given to us in 551 BC. Now there's another interesting thing that happens here tonight. The first chapter of Daniel and the first four verses of chapter 2 were originally written in Hebrew. And then in chapter 2, verse 4, when those astrologers answer the king, from that point on, the book switches and the original language was Aramaic, the language of the Babylonians. Because from chapter 2 on, the book is about Gentile dominion. In chapter 8, the book switches back to Hebrew, which tells us that from this point on to the end, the focus is on Israel again. And so the first chapter and the first four verses of chapter 2 are written in Hebrew, talking about Israel. From chapter 2, verse 4 through chapter 7, the focus is mostly on Gentile dominion. And then beginning in chapter 8, it comes back to Hebrew again, telling us the focus is again on Israel. Now, some people will try to convince you that that means the two people wrote the book of Daniel. Neither one was named Daniel, because that's it's a popular belief among some, we'll call them theologians. The book of Daniel has such specific and accurate prophecy in it. The people who don't believe in prophecy have to find some way to prove that Daniel didn't write it. And so what you'll hear people say is, well, the book of Daniel is written in two languages. That means it had two authors. And since it tells the story of Israel so accurately, it had to be written after the fact, because nobody could know that much about the future, because they don't believe in predictive prophecy. They don't believe it can be done. And so they try to say that Daniel was written all after the fact. But there are several things I'll show you here as we go along that prove that Daniel couldn't have been written after the fact. And because of this, by the way, Daniel has been the most thoroughly researched book in the Bible. And because of the research, has become the most thoroughly authenticated book in the Bible, because it turns out that Daniel did write it. And he wrote the first chapter in Hebrew because he was talking about Jewish things. He wrote chapters 2 through 7 in Aramaic because he was talking about the Gentile world. And in chapter 8, he switches back to Hebrew because he's talking about the Jewish things again, the things that pertain primarily to Israel. Now, this is the chapter I told you about last time we were together, that the high priest showed to Alexander the Great when he came riding into Jerusalem to conquer the city. And we'll just give you this a little bit of the story now, and then I'll tell you the rest of it as we go. You know, Alexander the Great was a remarkable general, and people thought it was almost impossible the speed with which he conquered the known world. From age 19 to age 29, he conquered everything he could find, and then they could have gone further, but the men just said, look, after 10 years of this, we got more money than we could ever spend. We haven't been home for 10 years. What's the point of going any further here? They were almost to China. They were on the far side of India. He said, what is the point? Let's just go home. Let's call it over. We'll say we win, and let's just go home. And so he agreed, and they all went home, and the army was disbanded, and Alexander spent the last few years of his life in Babylon. He died there. Well, when he came into Jerusalem, as he was beginning to conquer these countries, you know, he's from Greece, so he starts up in the north and west, and he comes down around the end of the Mediterranean, and he just knocks off these countries as he goes, one after the other. Finally, he comes to Jerusalem. By this time, the legend surrounding him was so great that many countries, when they saw him coming, just walked out and surrendered to him. So he conquered many of these places without a battle, because they knew the foregone conclusion, he's going to win. He's won everywhere else. We got two choices. We can fight and die, or we can surrender and live. And so they decided they would surrender and live. And so this became sort of the way things worked. Before he got to Jerusalem, Alexander had this dream that he was riding up to the city. And as he was riding up to the city, all these men in white came out to meet him. And they handed him the city. So this was, he expected this to happen. So he's riding up to the city of Jerusalem with his armies. And sure enough, all of a sudden, these men all dressed in white come out to meet him. turns out it's the high priest, and it's the his retinue behind him, all in white with purple and things and all their finery. And he recognized it as a scene from his dream. He got down off his horse, and he came and bowed before the high priest. And for his part, the high priest had a scroll in his hand, and he opened up the scroll, and he showed it to Alexander, who read it, and he said, "This is about me." And the high priest said, "That's correct. It is about you." Alexander spared the city, did not conquer it, and from that point forward, he often appointed Jewish administrators over the areas that he conquered. And so they had a very close bond, the Jewish people and Alexander the Great. Now, the scroll that the high priest handed to Alexander, it was the book of Daniel, and it was open to what we call chapter 8. And so this is what we're going to get into tonight. Now, there's more to the story, but I want you to hear the rest of it as we go, because you will find out that that one event, more than anything else, made it possible for you to receive the gospel. And I'll show you how. But all good stories, you have to wait for the conclusion, right? And so this is one of those. So the first thing we know is this, we're going back to Hebrew tonight. But we're going to read in English anyway. So that's just a little aside. So Daniel chapter 8, verse 1 says, "In the third year of King Belshazzar, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me." He's talking about chapter 7. "And in my vision, I saw myself in the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal." Elam was the biblical name for Persia, whose name today is Iran. Susa became the capital of the Persian Empire. And so Daniel, being one of the officials in the Persian kingdom, is located in the capital city, Susa. It's about 230 miles east of Babylon. And it was the seat of government in the Persian kingdom. There is a tradition that Daniel's buried there today. And in fact, there is a shrine to him in Iran that is held in high esteem, not only by the Persian Jews, because there's a contingent of Jews who live in Iran. These are the ones who didn't go back after the Babylonian captivity. There's still a lot of Jewish people who live in Iran. But also, it turns out that Daniel was highly revered by the Shiite Muslims as well. And so there's a pilgrimage, a Muslim pilgrimage to Susa, which today I think is called Shash. And they go there to visit the tomb of Daniel, whom they hold in high esteem. Now, there are several traditional burial sites for Daniel, none of them are in Israel. There's one in Iraq, and there's one in Egypt. And several of these countries claim that Daniel's buried there, but it's most likely it was in Persia, because that's where he lived most of his life, that's where he died. And so it makes sense that it would be there. The people who claim him say that one of their great heroes went and dug him up and took him and moved him to their country. So who knows? We'll just go with the one. But he's there in the place where today, if you could go there, you could go and visit Daniel's tomb. Verse 3, "I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later." Now this is very similar to the vision of Daniel in chapter 7, only there it was a bear. This time it's a ram. But it turns out, and you won't have to take my word for this, turns out it's the same country. He's talking about Persia. The king of Persia, whenever they went into a battle, wore a ram's head crown on his head. And so there are lots of other things, but the best evidence we have that the ram represents Persia is in verse 20, where it says, "The angel Gabriel says to Daniel, 'The two-horned ram you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia.'" So that pretty much takes all the mystery out of it, doesn't it? So you don't have to be very bright to see the connection there. And so even we can catch that. And so we go to verse 3 now, and it says, "One of the horns was longer than the other." Remember how it was the other time, where one side was bigger than the other? And that's because it represents this coalition, Media, Persia. At the beginning, Media was the more powerful and more dominant. And Persia was the come along, but very soon Persia became the more powerful part of it. And so when he says one horn started off smaller but got bigger, he's talking about the Persia side of it. So one horn was longer than the other but grew up later. Verse 4, I watched the ram as he charged toward the west and the north and the south. No animal could stand against him, and none could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. And so he's talking about how the Persian kingdom spread throughout the Middle East and was a dominant world power for a couple of hundred years after they defeated Babylon. Now we're down to verse 5. As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between his eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. This is where Alexander recognized himself, because the symbol of his father, Philip of Macedon, was the one-horned goat. It was on their coins. In fact, you know the Aegean Sea? Well, in the Greek, that means Sea of the Goat. And so the whole, and of course, the Aegean Sea surrounds Greece, right? Or at least on one side. If you can surround something on one side, I don't know how that works, but the Aegean Sea, the word Aegean, comes from the Greek word for goat. And so it says in verse 6, he came toward the two-horned ram and that I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at him in a great rage. In verse 7, I saw him attack the ram furiously and striking the ram and shattering his two horns. And the ram was powerless to stand against him. The goat knocked him to the ground and trampled on him, and none could rescue the ram from his power. All right, that takes us down to the end of verse 7. Here's what happened. This was really out of character for Alexander to do this. He always preferred to conquer by negotiation. He only fought as a last resort. And he would come up to a city and he'd send an envoy in to ask them to surrender. And as I told you, before too long, the envoy brought back good news. But in the early days, he didn't, so he would have to fight. But when Alexander went after the Persians, he didn't offer any terms of surrender. It was a battle to the death right from the get-go. And here's the reason. As a younger man, Alexander had watched as the Persians humiliated his father in battle on several different occasions and were unnecessarily cruel to his people after they had conquered them. And he swore that he would take vengeance for that. And so he dedicated a good part of his young life to getting into a position where he could take on the Persians and beat them. And the first thing he did, and this is going to be the one that turns out to be so important to you, the first thing he did was he looked at his people, the people that later became Greece. They were, at the time, a bunch of warring tribes. They couldn't get along together. They couldn't ever unite behind a common goal to defeat the Persians. And this is why the Persians beat them time after time after time, because sooner or later, their own self-interest would conflict with the goal to beat the Persians, and the Persians would win. Alexander believed that this was due to the fact that they all spoke different languages, and therefore they misunderstood each other. He felt that if he could get them all to speak the same language, he could help them resolve their differences and show them that they had a lot more in common, a lot more uniting them than there was separating them. And he felt he could unify them against the Persians and defeat them. And he was correct. So Alexander and his father developed a new language, which is called today Common Greek, or Koinonia Greek, Fellowship Greek. It's the Greek of the Bible. And it was developed by Alexander and Philip and taught to these warring factions. He convinced them when they were meeting together to all use that language when they spoke. And sure enough, little by little, before very long, they began to become more cooperative with one another. And pretty soon he had the whole Greek system of independent, semi-autonomous city-states brought together under a unified Greece. And they were a force to be reckoned with. And when he got that done, he went after the Persians. And he whacked them good. With just 35,000 troops, he completely destroyed the Persian army of over 200,000 men. And basically, that was the end of the Grecian Empire. And that's what really got Alexander started with his supernatural reputation. Because who ever heard of defeating an army seven times bigger than you are? And doing it when you're only 18 years old. And here's a group that formerly had never been able to win anything. It's like these movies and things you see, like the Bad News Bears and the Mighty Ducks, and where they take this misfit group that can't ever do anything right, and none of them has any talent at all, and this coach comes along and he instills in them the sense of teamwork and unity, and they go out and they beat the world. Well, it comes from what Alexander the Great here did against the Persians. He did this, I'm sorry, he wasn't 19, he was 22, so he was quite a bit older. And he did this in 331 BC, and this really made the Greek Empire the head of the known world. Alexander thought that that was such a good idea to make all of his troops speak the same language. He said, that works so well that we're going to enforce this language in every country we conquer. And they did. The Greek language became the language of the world. Alexander felt that if he could get everybody speaking the same language, he could have a world of peace. He knew he was going to have a pretty strong army to get it going, but he felt like if he could just get it moving, he could, within a generation, have a world at peace with one another. And this was his goal. And everywhere he went, he enforced this Greek language. You know, even in the time of Christ, when the Greeks were long gone and the Romans were in charge of the world, you know, the official language of the world was still Greek, even in that day. Now, here's the end of the story. Because in the time of Christ, the Greek language had become the official language of the known world, when the apostles, including Paul, went out to bring the good news to everybody, they had a language that everybody understood. And because everybody understood what they were saying, the gospel spread quickly throughout the known world. And it's all because of Alexander. And you see, I believe that this was God's plan right from the start, that he was working all these, pulling all these strings behind the scenes to make it happen, because he knew when he finally got Paul going, that he was going to have something that would help him spread this word. And so the Gospels were written in the Greek language. The evangelism that was done in all these countries was done in the Greek language. Many of the most famous idioms of the Scriptures are from the Greek language. You know, when at the end of the Lord's life, he hung there on the cross, and in John 19:30, it says in the English, it is finished. The last words he spoke from the cross, it is finished. The Greek word he spoke there was tetelestai. That was an official legal term that was written on every invoice, everywhere in the known world, whenever a person paid a bill in full. The word tetelestai was written across it. Whenever any prisoner served his complete sentence and was set free, they took the judgment against him and they wrote the word tetelestai across it. So, and he carried that with him so he could never be charged with that crime again. He could show them that he paid his debt in full for that crime. And so we translate it, it is finished, and we think of, okay, the Lord is dying now. This is his last words. My life is over. It's finished. That's not what he was saying at all. He was saying, paid in full. Isn't that interesting? Now, they knew all that in those days because it was part of the Greek language. And because the Greek language was the official language of the known world, this news spread far and wide much more quickly than it ever would have otherwise. All right, so now you know how Alexander helped spread the gospel and made a lot of it possible for us today. And you understand why, although all the gospel writers were Jewish, they all wrote in Greek, because that was the official language of the day. In fact, in Alexander's time, it got to the point where even Jewish people couldn't read their own scriptures anymore. And so heads of the successors to Alexander, still with this affinity for the Hebrew people, commissioned a group of 70 Hebrew scholars to translate the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek so that the world could understand the Hebrew Scriptures, so the people in Israel could understand their own Scriptures. And so starting in about 270 BC up until about 150, they worked on translating various books of the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek. All the Old Testament quotes that are given in the New Testament, whenever one of the people quoted something, even Jesus, when he quoted the Old Testament, he always quoted from the Greek version. It's called the Septuagint version. Septuagint is a word that stands for 70, and there were 70 scholars who got together and did this. They started with the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. Then they worked on some of the prophets, and then they worked on the Psalms. But starting in 270 BC, by about 150 BC, it was all complete. And so the entire Hebrew Scripture was pretty much a matter of record, including the 300 prophecies of the first coming of Jesus were a matter of public record at least 150 years before his birth, and in a language that everybody in the world could understand. It's fascinating when you see the rest of this. You don't learn this part of world history in the 10th grade when you're in high school, but it's the part that's probably more important than whatever it is we did learn. How many of you remember anything from your, okay? All right, you get the idea. All right, so where are we down? Down to verse 8. The goat became very great, but at the height of his power, his large horn was broken off. Now, you remember in apocalyptic language, the word horn always is a symbol for power or authority. The dragon has 7 heads and 10 horns. Lots of power, lots of authority. And here it says, at the height of his power, the large horn was broken off. After Alexander had conquered the known world and his armies convinced him to take the rest of his life off, he went home and within a very short period of time drank himself to death, wept on his bed, Josephus tells us, because there were no more worlds for him to conquer. They had sort of retired him too early. And so he died a premature death, and this was prophesied here. Because you remember, this was written in 551 BC, 200 years before Alexander. And in his place, this is the rest of verse 8, and in his place, 4 prominent horns grew up toward the 4 winds of heaven. We talked about this in chapter 7. When Alexander lay dying, he had 4 staff of 4 generals that commanded his armies. These 4 generals came in to him as he lay dying, and they said, who does the kingdom go to? You know, who's going to inherit all this? And he said, give it to the strong. And they assumed that that meant them. And so he died a short time later. They got rid of his son, who was the legitimate heir probably, but a very, in their opinion at least, a very weak person. And these 4 generals divided up the Greek Empire into 4 segments. And that's what it's talking about here, these 4 prominent horns. And we get to Daniel chapter 10. We're going to see what these 4 families did with the empire that they inherited. And in Daniel chapter 10, you'll find in 35 verses over 100 historically validated specific prophecies. Over 100 of them in 35 verses. And it has to do with the 200-year period that these 4 generals operated the remnants of Alexander's kingdom. This is one of the main reasons that scholars who don't believe in predictive prophecy have been so desperate to find some way to prove that Alexander didn't write this, somebody else had to write it after the fact. But they were unable to do that, and so the book stands. Of course, they could have saved a lot of time because Jesus called Daniel a prophet. That should have been enough for everybody, but often it isn't. Verse 9. Now, here is where you're going to see this dual fulfillment take place, because we're going to see somebody here who actually turns out to be 2 people, not just 1. And these 2 people are separated by over 2,000 years. Now, verse 9 says, out of one of them came another horn, which started small, but grew in power to the south and to the east, and toward the beautiful land. The beautiful land is the name for Israel. Now, verse 9 is okay because it says, out of one of them came another horn. In other words, out of one of these 4 families, these generals, it was Cassander and Lysimachus and Ptolemy and Seleucus. These were his 4 generals. And out of one of them came another horn, another power, another figure. So from one of these families, another power. He starts out small, but grew in power to the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land. So this little horn, if you will, is going to become a very powerful person, and he's going to start expanding his power to the south and east. And of course, Israel's right in the way, because it turns out that this power is from the family of Seleucus, who, when they divided up the empire, he got what we call today Lebanon, Assyria, Turkey, Asia Minor, it was called in those days, and that's the part that he got. Cassander, I believe it was, got the original land, Greece, Macedonia, that area over in the northern part of the Mediterranean. Lysimachus got the parts east toward India, and Ptolemy got what was called in those days Palestine and Egypt. It turns out that with this little horn in verse 9 comes from the family of Seleucus, because his power grew to the south and east. And south of his land, of course, is Israel. Remember, you got Lebanon and Syria and Asia Minor. Directly south of there is Israel. To the east is the land that Lysimachus had taken, Seleucus had very quickly conquered all of the lands that belonged to Lysimachus, and they made an arrangement, and so the Seleucus family wound up with not only their portion but also the portion that belonged to Lysimachus. So they basically had land that pretty much surrounded Israel and Egypt, and they are going to go at it with the families of Ptolemy for the next 200 years, and that's what Daniel 10 is all about. This particular little horn is a man who we know in history as Antiochus IV. And he's a famous guy because he called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means God made manifest, or God in the flesh, if you will. This was his name for himself. At the beginning, the Jews sort of laughed at him, and they call him Antiochus Epiphanes. And it turns out in Hebrew, the word Epiphanes, remember, Epiphanes means God made manifest? Epiphanes means the madman. And so they call him Antiochus the madman because he was a madman. But he called himself basically God in the flesh. He is responsible for the event we know in history as the Maccabean revolt, because he came south into Israel, conquered the nation, took it away from the Ptolemies, went all the way into Egypt. He was going to take all of their lands. He already got all the land to the east. Now he was going to take all of Egypt. But the Ptolemies weren't ready to yield, and they made an alliance with a country that nobody had ever heard of named Rome. And they teamed up and stopped Antiochus Epiphanes near Alexandria in Egypt and stopped his army there. And then they gave Antiochus the opportunity to withdraw. They had his army surrounded. He said, I'll think about it. And the Roman general, we're going to learn more about this when we get to chapter 10, whose name was Lucius Syaticus, I think. The Roman, it was an admiral, because it was the naval forces of Rome that came in behind him and blocked him in. The Roman commander, let's call him, he walked up to Antiochus and he took his sword and he drew a circle in the sand about 30 inches in diameter around Antiochus. And he said to him, take all the time you want, but if you step outside that circle, I'm going to kill you. And he said, take my advice and get your armies and get out of here and go back. Antiochus knew he was defeated, so he went back, and in an absolute rage, he took all his anger out on the Jews. He stormed into Jerusalem, broke into the temple precincts, slaughtered 20,000 priests. He turned the temple into a pagan worship center. He had a statue of Zeus, the Greek god, who was also the Roman god Jupiter, built, but he had the sculptor put his own face on it so that he was the statue. He put the statue in the Holy of Holies and required everyone to worship it on pain of death. And then he went to the holy altar and he forbade the sacrifice of lambs and bulls and oxen, and required only pigs could be sacrificed. Now, if you know anything about how the Jewish people feel about pigs, you know what kind of problem that caused. This resulted in the Maccabean revolt. It resulted in the defeat of Antiochus. It resulted in the desolation of the temple, and for a little over 3-year period, the temple was unfit for use because it had been rendered unclean by these acts. And eventually, after the Maccabees had defeated Antiochus, the temple was cleansed and rededicated. The event of his rededication is celebrated even today as Hanukkah. And so that's a quick summary of this. We're going to get more into this in a couple of chapters, but I want you to see that. That is this little horn. Now, you remember in Daniel 7, we saw a little horn coming out of the fourth kingdom. But here we're seeing the little horn coming out of the third kingdom. So that's why I tell you, he starts out as two different people. This is not, so far, the one we call the Antichrist, because the Antichrist comes out of the fourth kingdom, the revived Rome. This one came out of the what we would call today the Syrian kingdom of Antiochus. But look at verse 10 and look what happens here. It says, it grew until it reached the host of the heavens. This is a little horn. Grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. And it set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. Verse 12, because of the rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. Now, a lot of this happened during the reign of Antiochus, but some of it did not. And so this is how we know that Antiochus became a local fulfillment, or the first fulfillment of a dual fulfillment prophecy. Because if you go with me to Revelation chapter 12, we're going to read in 12 and 13 some things that I think will sound familiar to you based on what we just talked about. Revelation 12 and 13. I don't know, some of you may be fairly new to prophecy, and if you are, I apologize. Because we're into something fairly complex here, and if you have any questions about it, please write them down or something. I'll make time for questions at the end. We sort of have to keep moving while we're taping, but I will leave some time for questions. So if you have a question as we're going along, just write it down. We'll look at it as we get some time at the end. In Revelation 12, we'll start at verse 3. Another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to earth. Now that sentence fits with this one where it says in verse 10 of Daniel 7, or 8 rather, it grew until it reached the host of heavens and threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. And so you see in Revelation 12, this whoever's doing this is called the red dragon. In Daniel 8, it's this little horn. And so we know that this little horn didn't do this. And so verse 10 has to be a vision of the ultimate fulfillment of this prophecy, the Antichrist, who is empowered by Satan, as we'll see in a minute. Verse 11 says, it sets itself up to be as great as the prince of the host, and took away the daily sacrifice from him, and from the place of his sanctuary was brought low. This Antiochus accomplished when he made the statue of Zeus, put his own face on it, and basically required himself to be worshipped as God. And the temple was brought low. It's an event called in history the Abomination of Desolation. It's only happened once ever, and it happened during the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes when he turned the temple of God into a pagan worship center. But it's not the last time it will happen. The Bible says in the future this will happen again. Turn with me to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4, speaking of the Antichrist, says, he will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. Now, Paul wrote this about 200 years after Antiochus Epiphanes had died, and told us to look for it in the future. And so he said there would come a future time when someone would stand in the temple, proclaim himself to be God, require himself to be worshipped on pain of death. Jesus talked about that same time in Matthew chapter 24, and he was even more specific. In Matthew 24, he said in verse 15, "When you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee into the mountains," because he said in verse 21, that will be the start of the great tribulation. And again, Jesus spoke about it almost 200 years before or after the fact, and yet he told people to look for it in the end times as a sign that the great tribulation had begun. And so that tells us there will be another abomination of desolation. There will be another somebody who comes and stands in the temple, proclaiming himself to be God, requiring that he be worshipped, making the temple desolate, unfit for God's use. Now, what that tells us is that one of the major signs that the end of the age is upon us will be the building of a temple in Israel, because the Antichrist needs a temple there to reveal himself as God. We're going to see this spoken of again next time in Daniel chapter 9, and so we'll go into more detail there, because that's where the major prophecy is about it. But I want you to see that this prophecy here in Daniel 8, this little horn, was Antiochus Epiphanes in the first fulfillment, will be the Antichrist in the second fulfillment. And the purpose of the first fulfillment is to confirm that the prophecy will take place. When Jesus told us to look for the abomination of desolation, he used the same phrase that Daniel used here, so that we would know exactly what to look for. It's only happened once in history. It's when a man stands in the holy place, proclaims himself to be God, demanding to be worshipped. That is the event that begins the great tribulation. And because it's happened once, the people on earth during that time will know, when they see it again, exactly what it is and what's happening. But we're going to have lots more opportunities to talk about this, and so we need to keep moving here on tonight's session. Verse 12, "Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground." All right, now we're going to go back in verse 13 of Daniel 8 to the first fulfillment. The angel has given Daniel the complete story of how this little horn is going to come, do some things, come again, do some things. Now we're going to go back and fill in some detail. Verse 13, "I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, 'How long it will take for the vision to be fulfilled?' The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, and the surrender of the sanctuary and of the host that will be trampled underfoot." So he's saying, how long will it take for him to do all these things? How long is this going to last? In verse 14, he said to me, "It will take 2,300 evenings and mornings, and then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated." In Genesis chapter 1, on each of the 6 days of creation, God said, "And there was evening, and there was morning, day one. And there was evening, and there was morning, day two. And there was evening, and there was morning, day three." So when this guy says 2,300 evenings and mornings, he's talking about days, but it's not 2,300 evenings and mornings equals one day. It's 2,300 evenings, 2,300 mornings. So you have to divide it in two. It's 1,150 days. And that's exactly the duration of the period of desolation of the temple during the time of the rebellion of Antiochus Epiphanes and the Maccabees. It started on the 25th day of Kislev in 168 BC, and it was ended on the 25th day of Kislev in 165 BC. It was 3 years. There was a 2-month period before the statue was set up, after Antiochus defiled the altar of God. There was a 2-month period before he actually put his statue in the holy place and required it to be worshipped. And that adds the other, 70 days, because 1,150 days equals 3 years and 70 days. And so we know by that he's talking about the first fulfillment, because in three different places in the book of Revelation, and also in the book of Daniel, it says the next time it will happen, at the end of the age, it will consume 1,260 days. Or he said, if you prefer, it will consume 42 months, or it will consume 3.5 years. And it turns out on God's calendar, those are three equivalent terms. 3.5 years is 42 months. 42 months is 1,260 days. And so the end times fulfillment is different from what we're talking about here, because the angel specifically says this is 1,150 days. And he says then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. And after the Maccabees defeated Antiochus, they came back, they tore off the old altar, they destroyed the statue, they got rid of everything in the temple that had been defiled by this pagan worship, and they reconsecrated and rededicated the temple. And as I say, it's celebrated today in the Feast of Hanukkah, which takes place right around our Christmas time. All right, so there's the first 14 verses. Now we can finish up pretty quickly, because now the angel's going to tell Daniel everything that I've just told you. and so you'll have it on better authority this time. Verse 15 says, "While I, Daniel, was watching the vision and trying to understand it, there stood before me one who looked like a man. In verse 16, I heard a man's voice from the Ulai calling, 'Gabriel, tell this man the meaning of the vision.'" So the angel Gabriel is here. Angel Gabriel has one job. He talks about the Messiah and things having to do with Messiah. He's the messianic messenger. He's the one who came to John the Baptist's father, Zechariah. He's the one who came to Mary. The angel Gabriel is the messianic messenger. He's going to talk to Daniel a couple more times. Verse 17, "As he came near the place where I was standing, I was terrified and fell prostrate. 'Son of man,' he said to me, 'understand, the vision concerns the time of the end.' And while he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Then he touched me and raised me to my feet." Verse 19, he said, "I'm going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath." That's the time of the great tribulation. "Because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end." Now, verse 20, "The two-horned ram you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia." In verse 21, "The shaggy goat is the king of Greece." These are kingdoms that haven't come on the scene yet when he's telling this to Daniel. "And the large horn between his eyes is the first king. The four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent four kingdoms that will emerge from this nation, but will not have the same power." Verse 23, "In the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a stern-faced king, a master of intrigue, will arise." This is the second iteration of this little horn. In the latter part of the reign of the Gentile dominion, when the rebels have become completely wicked. Are people completely wicked yet? Almost, but not yet. There's one thing that's preventing it. The Holy Spirit resident in the church is preventing it. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 7 tells us that. It says, "The secret power of lawlessness is already at work, but the one who now holds it back will continue to do so until he's taken out of the way." And verse 8 says, "And then the lawless one will be revealed." And so the lawless one, a title for the Antichrist, can't be revealed until the one who holds him back is taken out of the way. Most scholars see the one who is holding back evil in the world today as being the Holy Spirit resident in the church. There will come a time when the Holy Spirit will be taken out of the earth before the judgment, just like he was taken out of the earth before the flood. He'll be taken out of the earth again before this judgment. And then man will become completely evil. And Daniel 8:23 says, "When the rebels have become completely wicked," which means after the Holy Spirit is gone, "a stern-faced king, a master of intrigue, will arise. He'll become very strong, but not by his own power." And here again, we know that this is not Antiochus, because this one is going to have some supernatural power. In Revelation 13, of chapter 13, in the first couple of verses, we learn who his power is. It says, "The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and his great authority." So this second iteration, the Antichrist, will derive his power from the dragon. Well, who's the dragon? Turn back a page, And in 12:9 it says, "The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray." And so at the end of the age, after the Antichrist has taken power, the Holy Spirit has taken the church away, Satan will become the source of power for the Antichrist. And it says in chapter 13 again that the world will worship Satan, and they'll worship the Antichrist because of this incredible power that he has. It says back in Daniel 8, he'll cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He'll destroy the mighty men and the holy people. He'll cause deceit to prosper and will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he'll destroy many and take a stand against the prince of princes. And yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. I like the King James on this verse a little better. In verse 25, the King James says something like, "He'll cause deceit to prosper and will consider himself superior, and by means of peace will destroy many." This tells us that the Antichrist, when he first comes on the scene, will appear to the world as if he's a man of peace. I believe he'll come right after the great battle of Ezekiel 38, when the world is in shock because of all the destruction that's taken place when the Muslim coalition comes against Israel and is defeated by God himself. They'll be looking for some way to restore peace to the world, and that will be when the Antichrist makes his appearance. And he'll bring the peace plan, which will, in fact, begin the last 7 years of human history and result in the almost total destruction of Earth. But he starts off people believing he's a man of peace. Revelation 6 says he arrives on a white horse with a crown on his head, and everybody thinks he's this great person. You know, the man on the white horse is always the hero. But very shortly, the man on the red horse comes behind him and takes peace away from the world. And then there's war and famine and pestilence and sickness and death. And those are all the things of the other horses of the apocalypse. But it says that the Antichrist will first appear to many to be a man of peace. And then he'll destroy many and take his stand against the prince of princes. This is speaking about the Lord himself. And didn't we just read in Thessalonians chapter 2 that the Antichrist will say he'll set himself up against everything that's called God or is worshipped, proclaiming himself to be God. Now you think of all the things in the world that are called God or that are worshipped. And he'll say, "No, I'm superior to all of those. Doesn't matter what religion you are," he'll say, "I'm superior to your gods. I'm superior to the God of the Hindus. I'm superior to the God of the Buddhists. I'm superior to the God of the Muslims. I'm superior to the God of the Jews. I'm superior to every God. I, in fact, am God." This will be his claim. And you know what? Most of the world will believe it. Because you see, the source of truth in the world will be gone by then. There won't be any more church. There won't be any more Bible studies like this going on. There won't be any reading of this book. I think it's in the book of Amos. God says at the end of the age, I'm going to cause a great famine. But it won't be a famine of food or water. It'll be a famine of hearing the words of the Lord. When the truth is gone, the lie can prevail. Now, verse 26, "The vision of the evenings and the morning that has been given you is true." In other words, the first fulfillment will happen too. I've been talking, it's like Gabriel saying to Daniel, we've been talking here about the end of the age. But he says, don't forget, the first fulfillment will take place as well. But seal up the vision, for it concerns the distant future. And 27, "I, Daniel, was exhausted and lay ill for several days. And then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled by the vision. It was beyond understanding." I would say. And it still is. I mean, you imagine this thing happening. We have the advantage, if you will, of being able to go to the first book of Maccabees and reading about this as history, having seen it in the book of Daniel as prophecy. Because the two books of Maccabees, which aren't in the Bible, so they're not considered inspired writings, but they're felt by most scholars to be good historical accounts of events. And if you read 1 Maccabees, in the first couple of chapters, you see the event of the arrival on the scene, if you will, of Antiochus the Fourth, who named himself Epiphanes, and you see the things he caused to have happen. He forbade the speaking of Hebrew, in public or private. He forbade the reading of the Old Testament scriptures, or even owning the scriptures. He burned every copy he could find. It was a capital crime to be caught with a Bible in your hands or in your possession. Mothers could not teach their children about God on pain of death. You couldn't worship him anywhere. You could only worship Antiochus Epiphanes. This is the closest description we have anywhere of what it will be like during the Great Tribulation. It won't be any fun. You should not permit, if you have any way to stop it, even your worst enemy from being taken by surprise by these events, because you wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. It's a time that no one would want to live through or to have to endure. But it's a time that is coming. We read about here in Daniel 8. We're going to read about it again in Daniel 9 next time. We're going to read about it again in Daniel chapter 10. We're going to read about it again in the last half of Daniel 11. And we're going to read about it again in Daniel chapter 12. This was a preoccupation of his. And he got 5 separate visions about how this was all going to happen. And you put all the visions together and you get the most complete description of the end of the age that you'll find anywhere. It's no wonder he went to bed sick, because he saw all this coming, and he saw it in the kind of detail that it makes you sick when you start thinking about how the world is going to be. We have no clue. We have no way of imagining that. But if you read First Book of Maccabees, the first couple of chapters, you'll get a view of it. Writers have tried to describe it. People have tried to write about the history of the Maccabean Revolt, and it's difficult to do because of the atrocities that were committed. Amazing, amazing stuff. It's, you know what some of the Muslim people are doing to each other over in the Middle East today? They're killing each other. They're throwing each other off buildings. They're doing terrible things to people, to people who don't agree with their brand of their religion. One group drove 3 oil tankers into a city in northern Iraq this week, loaded with 250 tons of explosives, and blew up a village of 20,000 people. 500 of them killed immediately, the whole village destroyed, just to show that they could. And just because they wanted to distract the people in Iraq from thinking that there's any possibility that they could have peace. Now, they weren't blowing up American soldiers. They were blowing up each other, innocent civilians, just to show that they were going to have chaos instead of order, because that's what they desire. It's going to be worse than that. It's going to be worse than you can imagine. If you look at the prophecies of Revelation, and if you do the math, you find out that during that 7-year period, there will be an average of 1.2 million people who die every single day. 1/2 of the population of the world will be dead before it's over. Those aren't good odds. Nobody would want to try and survive through that. Nobody would say, well, I think I can stick that out. I think I can make that. I can get through those 7 years and be one of the ones that live. Nobody would set out to do that. But this will come upon a world that is sound asleep, who thinks peace has arrived. But of course, in the absence of God, you can't have peace. So that is chapter 8. The very best thing I can tell you about chapter 8 is that you and I will view this from the mezzanine. We won't be here for that period of time. We can know about it. We can know that it's coming. We can thank God that he has come into our hearts in advance of these events and has promised to protect us from that. That's the best thing about it. The second best thing is it hasn't happened yet, and so there's an opportunity for us to see if there's just the slightest possibility that somebody we've been talking to might be convinced if we tried one more time to convince them. Because there still is a little bit of time. We don't know how much. We won't until it's over. But there still is a little bit of time. And we can still have an impact for good in the lives of people around us who haven't made up their minds yet. We can show them, look, this happened in history. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Old Testament prophecies that have already been fulfilled in history. Why would you believe that God will suddenly stop doing that and not fulfill the rest of them? What kind of logic is there in that? It doesn't make sense, does it? But to some people, that's the logic. Others say, well, I'm going to see if I can work out a deal when I meet God face to face. I'm going to see if I can change his mind. You know, folks, that's the creature defying the creator and daring him to do what he said he would do and then trying to work out a deal. You know, when I stop to think about it, isn't that exactly what Satan has done? Isn't Satan a creature who has defied the creator and has spent the last however many millennia trying to get him to change his mind about the things he said he would do? And isn't he hoping to work out some kind of deal at the end? How do you think that's going to work for him? And yet there are people in the world who have adopted that very same strategy. And they think it's a sound strategy. I'm preaching to the choir here, I know. And so let's have a closing prayer, and then we'll have some time for your questions if you have some.
Thanks for listening to this study. For more free Bible study resources, visit gracethroughfaith.com.